The Women's Podcast, brought to you by Ravo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.
Welcome back to episode 8 of The Women's Podcast, which you can subscribe to on iTunes, Stitcher and SoundCloud. We've another great episode lined up. We have words of wisdom from Erica Jong, who brought us the concept of, hold on to your hats, the zipless fuck, all those years ago.
This is Erica Jong for the Irish Times Women's Podcast.
We have some powerful recordings from a spoken word event at the Bram Stoker Festival, and we talked to the women behind a new reworking of Coppelia from Ballet Ireland. But first, we had a massive response to our question of the week. It was prompted by the Feminist Film Festival, which was on last weekend, and the question was, what film should every woman see and why? Most of you couldn't settle for just one, and like author Marion Keyes gave us lots of suggestions. Marion's included Gone with the Wind, because that there Scarlett O'Hara is just fabulous. Frozen, because the true love was between sisters and not between the lady and the man, smiley face. And Roman Holiday, because it shows how not to live a life, i.e. being dutiful and doing what's expected. Also Audrey's hair. Daphne Erner emailed us at thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com to say fried green tomatoes, and she was not the only one. Firstly, because it's a delicate film that talks about sensitive subjects in a delicate way, and because the character portrayed by Kathy Bates, whose supermarket parking scene is my all-time favourite, said Daphne, highlights how difficult it can be for nice ladies to break the binds that hold them back. Mary Moynihan picked Distant Voices, Still Lives because many young women have no knowledge of how much things have improved for women since post-war Britain due to the feminist revolution. And that cannot be said often enough, Mary. Moira Reedy had a long list of good ones and many of you agreed with her. Bridget Jones's Diary, because every woman is Bridget Jones in one way or another. Working Girl, because it's about a hard-working woman who wants to have a better life and how she goes about it. And Harrison Ford Strips Off. And I'd say also it's got Dolly Parton, who I could look at forever. Educating Rita, for the same reason, minus Harrison Ford. Shirley Valentine, because she's a legend, and a lot of married women from that era could and can identify with her, and it's very funny. Frances Ha, similar theme to Educating Rita and Working Girl. Darling, starring Julie Christie as a young model who's bored with her marriage and her life and is looking for more and can't seem to figure out what that is or who she is. There's Poor Cow, which I remember from its first showing, which is nearly 50 years ago, directed by Ken Loach, about a young working class mother and her struggle to find a better life. Emmett McNamara tweeted us to nominate Winter's Bone because it's the type of story that's usually told from a male point of view, but not this time. It's really good, he says. Thank you all for that wonderful response. I'll tell you this week's question at the end of the episode. In 1973, Erica Jong's book Fear of Flying launched a million dinner party conversations when she introduced us to the concept of the zipless fuck. If you think that's a rude concept now, well, let me tell you, it was a fairly radical notion for a woman 42 years ago. For those who missed it the first time around, here's what Erica Jong said. The zipless fuck is absolutely pure. It is free of ulterior motives. There is no power game. The man is not taking and the woman is not giving. No one is attempting to cuckold a husband or humiliate a wife. No one is trying to prove anything or get anything out of anyone. The zipless fuck is the purest thing there is, and it is rarer than the unicorn, and I have never had one. And now, a decade after her last novel was published, Erica Jong is back with a sequel to Fear of Flying, which, by the way, sold 27 million copies. And this new book is called Fear of Dying. And in this, Vanessa Wunderman is a 60-year-old actor pretending to be 50, which is a big job in itself, I can tell you, while doing battle with dying parents, an 80-something husband with erectile dysfunction, a daughter expecting her first child, and a poor sick poodle called Belinda Barkowitz. And Erica joins me on the phone from London now. Hello, Erica.
Hello, how are you?
I am wonderful. Why aren't you in Dublin?
I don't know. But I thought, when I saw all these interviews with Irish papers, I thought, oh, yay, I'm going to Dublin. I adore Dublin. I adore Ireland, actually. And I've seen quite a bit of it. And then I realized I wasn't coming to your beautiful country, and I was very disappointed.
Well, so are we. So are we. And it's taken 10 years to write this novel, Erica, so you've obviously had a lot on your mind in the meantime. Does the 10 years reflect the difficulty of confronting the themes of growing old and confronting decrepitude?
Well, first of all, it was very hard to write this book, Fear of Dying, for a lot of reasons. I started out trying to write about Isadora turning 60, and the voice wasn't there for me because that character had so much baggage. It was just impossible for me to find. You know, for me, the book begins with finding the voice, and I just couldn't find it. I felt that Isadora was weighted down with expectation from readers and from me. So that was my first struggle. And then the voice of Vanessa Wunderman, this sort of bouncy, funny, fierce actor who can't act anymore because she's 60. Then I started to get that voice, and it seemed like it was the right voice for the book. Also, she's an actor. So for actors, getting older is even worse than for writers or normal people.
That's a really interesting point, Erica. You've actually hit the zeitgeist on this, because Fear of Dying is landing bang in the middle of a debate about the social and cultural obstacles older women face generally.
Yes.
Mainly invisibility or dismissal as old spinsters or crones. So was that very much in your mind, on your own mind, when you were writing this?
Very much. And it was important that the heroine, Vanessa, was an actress or an actor because, and there's a difference between actor and actress, because the guys go on forever.
Yes.
And the women stop working. And they stop getting good parts. You probably remember Betty Davis at the end of her career, at the end of a great dramatic career. She's playing in horror movies with her face painted green. And that is what happens to women in the business. And the sad truth is, here we are all these years after Betty Davis, and it's still happening. So, you know, many people have spoken out about it. Meryl Streep has. Also, she's talked about the fact that female actors make half the money of males, you know. And with somebody as successful as Meryl Streep, it doesn't come across as sour grapes, because she's so proficient, she can do anything, and yet she feels the limitation. Well, you can imagine, if she feels the limitation, what's it like for the television actor, for the, you know, the woman who's in B movies, or what we used to call B movies? They really have no opportunities after a certain age. And I'm very aware of this because many of my friends are in that business. One of my dearest friends, Shirley Knight, used to say to me around the time she turned 60, she would say, you know, I know my craft better than I ever did. I would like to play Lear, and they want me to play grannies.
Erica, Is it all related? Does it all come back to sex? I mean, you have a couple of lines in your book. Women were not allowed to have passion at 60. We were supposed to become grandmothers and retreat into serene sexlessness. Is it all related?
That is true. I think that is true. And there are a few women actors who have defied these stereotypes. You know, one of them is Joan Collins, but she doesn't work as much as she used to. And it's true that it's slightly better in the theater because it's not high definition. You can still act in the theater. But still, women don't get the parts. And women are not considered passionate creatures when they pass 60, which is insane to me. Just crazy.
And it's in fact almost at the heart of the book, isn't it? Is Vanessa looking for this connection, trying to find some kind of rejuvenation, and she hits on a website which is interestingly called zipless.com, which struck me, Erica, as being an Ashley Madison. I don't know if you're familiar with the Ashley Madison controversy.
Oh, sure.
Of course you are.
You know, I invented Ziplist.com some years before Ashley Madison existed. And the joke of it was that they had taken Isadora's phrase, stolen it from her, copyrighted it, which she wasn't smart enough to do, and they were using it as a sex site. There's a lot of the stuff about sex on the internet in Fear of Dying is deeply satirical. So, I mean, I'm sure there are people who meet wonderful people on the internet. My daughter met her husband on the internet. But I think those sites like Ashley Madison and Tinder and others are profoundly dangerous. And what happens to my character, Vanessa, is she meets a selection of perverts, fetishists, and crazy people. And I think that is out there. There are also nice people out there, but how do you know that you're not going to meet a lunatic?
And actually, in the book, Erica, one of the first people Vanessa meets, I think he may be the first, is this rather attractive man who insists he is happily married, who invites her down to his lovely hotel suite for a lunch of caviar and behaves as though everything is very laid back and wonderful, produces the rubber suit. puts across this rather violent undercurrent,
right,
which actually goes way beyond satire, I thought, Erica. I actually felt quite menaced at that point.
Well, I love that scene in the book, because Vanessa meets this man who calls himself David. She doesn't even know if that's his real name. She calls herself Serena. And against her better judgment, she goes to his hotel room. He feeds her champagne and caviar. And then he retreats into the other room and comes out with this rubber suit with strategically placed zippers, right? And he's kind of sheepish showing it to her. And then he said, well, there's other paraphernalia that goes with it, like masks and chains. We don't really know, but we can imagine the worst. And then when she says that that is not her thing, he gets enraged at her.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that is possible. Not that it's ever happened to me. It hasn't. But it's possible that somebody who's showing their deepest, darkest fantasy, if you say you don't share that fantasy, they may get enraged at you.
Erica, I think this is going to activate your gag reflex, but I have to say it, 50 Shades of Grey. Has that mainstreamed that kind of activity?
I have no idea, really. I can only say to you that it's such a dreadful book that it shocks me that people can even get through it. And I had to read at least the first one because people kept asking me about it. So as research, I made a fighting try to read the damn thing. It is so badly written. It's so idiotic. But above that, it is a Cinderella story. It's the most retrograde fantasy. You have this 22-year-old virgin who's in college. I doubt that there are many of those in American colleges. Okay, but you have a billionaire of 25.
Lots of them around.
What? Lots of them around. And he's, when he can't get her attention to sign a submissive contract, a contract promising submission, he starts buying her things. So the first thing he buys her is a computer because she can't afford one. Then he buys her a car because she can't afford one. Then she signs a contract promising submissiveness. Well, what is this fantasy? This is Cinderella, basically. This is woman takes stuff from man and act submissive. I think it's so retrograde that I can't even imagine who would find it a turn on.
And yet, Erica, you and I, and lots of other women like us, have to face the fact that this has been one of the biggest selling books. It's been a phenomenon.
Yeah.
All 25,000 of them. I don't know how many she's written, but anyway, there's a lot of them. It's been a publishing phenomenon. Can you explain that in any way?
Well, I explain it in the sense that for many, many years, women had no access to pornography of any sort. And this came as a novelty, and it would be buzzed about by friends. I mean, you know, all books sell ultimately by word of mouth. If your best girlfriend says, oh, God, you have to read this, it's phenomenal, then you buy it. And it certainly didn't go according to reviews, because the reviews were terrible. But I think that women had not had access to literary pornography. They suddenly had a chance to get their hands on a book. The story of O is far better written, but they had never heard of it, mm-hmm. right? Not many people read the Marquis de Sade, Justine, and Juliet. I did, because I was an 18th century specialist, and I wanted to know what these things were. They horrified me, by the way. I'm not into bondage and discipline.
Which is interesting, Erica, because everybody assumes you're into everything because of that original famous...
Well, you know, a lot of these pornography books do end with the woman dying, including L'Histoire d'O. You're aware of this. It doesn't happen in 50 Shades. Rather, she marries him. But another Cinderella element. But I think, you know, women just didn't have access to this written pornography. And when you have written pornography, you can imagine everything and make it fit your own fantasy.
And what's interesting about that, about the film version of the books, is that it was notable how many older women were going along in groups, you know, delighted with the fun night out and that sort of thing.
Yeah, a girl's night out.
A girl's night out, exactly. But in many ways, what it did show, Erica, was that there is a market for sexual older women, among older women at least.
Right.
So did that, it told us something about that, I think.
I think it did, and I think it showed what a hunger there is in women to be reminded that we need touch at every stage of our lives, from infancy to old age. It doesn't have to be what Anthony Burgess called the old in-out in Clockwork Orange. I mean, he coined, I think, the best phrase for intercourse, the old in out. I think it's hilarious. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that. But certainly touch, tongues, all of that is important. And it never has to leave your life if you enjoy it and you have a partner who enjoys it. We don't want to spend the last third of our lives untouched. And a lot of women do.
So, Erica, in the end, is Vanessa really the whole story? Is it about sex, or is it actually about losing the lovely, reckless joy and vitality of youth? She obviously has a terrible... She's obsessed with aging.
Well, she's an actress.
Yes.
And they are. But more than that, I think she does love her husband, but he's 20 years older, an experience many, many women have. And he's having heart surgery, and he's taking a medication that keeps him from having erections. And so she has to find a new way of connecting with him. And people do find new ways of connecting, no doubt about it. But initially, she's losing everything at once. She's losing her adorable dog, Belinda Barkowitz. She's losing youth. She's losing motherhood, because her daughter is having a baby, and her daughter becomes the mommy. And what is she? You know, she's grandma, which is a great thing to be. I have to tell you that being a grandmother is the happiest way to relate to children, in my opinion. And I now have four grandkids, two girls, two boys. And it's fabulous, and it makes me so happy. But, and I love these kids. But, you know, you have to, it's a passage, and it's a passage you have to get used to.
Erica, in the book, Vanessa goes on a rage against age, which I think is a great phrase. She goes to all the exercise gurus and the anti-aging specialists, the blasters and the scrapers and the injectors and the acupuncturists and the hypnotists. She does all of this. Would you have tried that yourself? Because I know a lot of your work is at least semi-autobiographical.
Well, I did have a facelift about 20 years ago, and I never lie about it because... But it was the greatest facelift anybody ever had. It never looked like a facelift. And at this point in my life, I don't do much. Yes, I go to the dermatologist, and I try to get rid of those little veins that we get as we get older.
Yes.
And yes, I occasionally have had Botox in the wrinkles in my forehead. They're not really wrinkles. They're frown lines. I haven't done it in a long, long time because I'm feeling like it may be poison, and who wants to do it? I know the pharmaceutical companies lie to us to get money, and I worry about all these things more and more because I don't believe their publicity, the pharmaceutical companies, and I believe it less and less. You know, I know of people who've committed suicide from taking anti-smoking drugs, people who've committed suicide from drugs that are advertised on TV. And I don't trust any of this stuff anymore.
And you do look wonderful, Vanessa, because or Erica Vanessa.
Vanessa.
I've seen the photographs and you look wonderful. So whatever is going on with that facelift still, it's paid for itself over and over.
The doctor was amazing, you know, just amazing. And he had done a friend of mine who's also a short, plump blonde. And she just looked so beautiful and just like herself. She lives in Mallorca. She knows a lot of, because her husband's an artist, and sells his paintings to a lot of Spanish royals. And she would, you know, she just looked fabulous. And she apparently found this doctor through Spanish noble ladies who had been screwed up by other doctors. And then they went to San Francisco to see this doctor. And he fixed everything and got rid of all the bad work. So when I saw my friend Jane, I just thought, this guy is fabulous.
Is this man still in action, Erica?
No. I mean, I'm sure he has students who worked with him. But he was born in 41, and usually surgeons don't operate after a certain period. He probably has been teaching younger doctors. I haven't seen him in ages, so I don't know.
Okay. I think a list on your website of his students might go down well.
You know...
Erica, the whole quest for physical perfection obviously is something that it is a phenomenon of the age, I'm afraid. And it's an anti-feminist message in many ways. It's something that should concern us all.
You know something? I don't think it's anti-feminist. I think that given the fact that women's beauty is too important to our power, it is not surprising that some women, particularly if they're in the public eye, choose to look younger. If we could go on television with all our wrinkles showing and talk, then that would be one thing. But if you're a news presenter, if you're an actor, if in any way you're in the public eye, you don't have that option, I think, because they won't put you on TV. Let's face it. I mean, this is not us being anti-feminist. This is our society being anti-feminist.
But, Eric, if we continue to go to the doctors in San Francisco and get ourselves perfected, or at least try to look 10 years younger,
you can't even get perfected. There's no way to be perfected.
But if we do that, if we continue to do that, Eric, are we not reinforcing this view of society that women should not go on television if they have wrinkles?
I don't see it that way. I mean, I don't think that Christiane Amanpour or Barbara Walters or whoever, Meryl Streep, can get away with that at this point. I mean, I would like women to have power in the world regardless of how they look, but we're not there yet.
You actually had said somewhere, Erica, that we've only had one third of a feminist revolution.
I do feel that. You know, I look at the feminist revolution as starting with Mary Wollstonecraft and Thomas Paine and the philosophes and the 18th century crusaders for freedom. That's where it started, with the Declaration of the Rights of Women by Mary Wollstonecraft, who was an 18th century woman who was interested in the rights of human beings, as were all her intellectual contemporaries. And she was in, you know, she used to go to dinner parties in London with Thomas Paine. This is the circle to which she belonged. So she began, in a way, the struggle for women to be included in the rights of men. If you go forward into the 19th century, the movement for suffrage begins there. And women went through hell to get suffrage. There were women force-fed in jails, beaten up, tortured, probably raped, but we don't know about it. And they finally got the vote. And at the beginning of the 20th century, we got the vote. Then women thought, oh, now we can relax because we have the vote. Not true. Things went back to the way they were. And the vote didn't matter all that much. And we still have a minority in the Congress of the United States. We have nothing near parity. We have much. We have many, many more women than we used to have, and they're fabulous women. But we don't have anywhere near 50%. So without making a huge change, I mean, in the UK, they have used certain things to get a larger percentage of women in the legislature. But in America, we have a pathetic number of women in Congress.
And yet, Erica, in the States, you have this very conspicuous new wave feminism, you know, the likes of Lena Dunham and those. Now, there's a lot of infighting going on, but nonetheless, it's very out there. So what do you think is blocking this? Are they not targeting the right places? What is going on?
No. You have these, excuse the expression, old farts who try to keep women out. I mean, look, I was watching BBC News yesterday morning when I was getting ready for my interviews. Do you know there are only 5 women who head UK companies?
Yes.
5.
And it's worse in Ireland, actually, I have to tell you.
Is it?
Yes.
I mean, this was reported on BBC One. 5 women. There has been a drive to get more women on corporate boards, and there are a few more. And then the reporter said, but only 5 chiefs of UK companies. You know, what is that about? That is about people look at women and they don't see leadership. They see their mother, their wife, their daughter. I don't know what they see, but we haven't really changed our society. And it's time to change it. When I traveled through California and I started in San Diego and went all the way to Seattle, all the women I met were wearing buttons that said, this is what a feminist looks like. My little niece who lives in L.A. pinned a button on me. She and all her friends were wearing it. They're 12 now. That said, this is what a feminist looks like. The other button they pinned on me was Earth for President.
Earth for President.
Uh-huh.
Mother Earth.
Earth. Meaning, we've got to have an environmentalist in the White House. I think we need Hillary in the White House. And she has been very brave in talking about the Keystone Pipeline. She's been very brave in talking about the rights of children. Children, by the way, are the most oppressed group in the world today. Just turn on your TV and look at those children dead on the beach on Sappho's Island, Mytilene. I mean, it's shocking.
It is.
It's really shocking.
Erica, tell me one last thing, and this is a very important question. The book is called...
Fear of Dying.
Fear of Dying. So we need to look at death, and I'm a baby boomer, as are you. Now, what do you recommend? Should we rage against the dying of the light, or just sort of ease up and fade away?
Look, I think it's really important that we face the fact that we are mortal creatures. Not easy. It's the hardest thing in the world. The Greeks, who knew everything, understood that there were only two subjects for poetry, love and death. This is true. You know, William Butler Yeats might have told you the same thing. Poets know there are only two subjects, love and death. And Ireland has the greatest poets in the modern world. We know that. So I started life as a poet, and I was very, very aware that those were my subjects. As you get older and your parents die, the whole idea of death takes on a vividness that it didn't have before. And we understand when our parents die, even in my very long-lived family, that we're next. And how to respond to this? Well, I think my feminism has gotten so much hotter since I've been older. Gloria Steinem once said, women are the only group in history who grow more radical with age. And it's true. As you pass menopause, you've become more and more fearless. Nobody can take you down. You speak your mind to anybody who wants to listen. And I think that's a great blessing. I also think that we face death by giving back, by generativity, what Eric Erickson called generativity. We cease to be so interested in our own egos, and we want to give back to other women, to the world. I think that mentoring is feminism, and feminism is mentoring. And my job, I mean, I've set up a program at my college called the Erica Mandjong Writing Foundation. I give a lot back to Barnard College. I give a lot to the scholarship fund. We now have 50% of our students on complete scholarship, which has so increased the diversity of our school. It's amazing. So I think you face aging by giving back. And if you're a feminist, you nurture younger feminists and you help them to change the world. That is my way of growing older.
Erica Jong, we couldn't go out in a more positive, more practical note. I could talk to you all weekend, quite frankly, but thank you so much for coming on the Irish Times Women's Podcast, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Amazing how a good discussion can change the way you think about something. At Rabo Direct, we like to have conversations that change the way you think about saving and help you reach your savings goals. As straight talkers, there'll be no waffle involved. And as the saving specialists, you can rest assured we'll have a pretty good idea what we're talking about. Rabodirect, the straight talking savings bank.
Last week at the Project Arts Centre, a very special spoken word evening took place, and our researcher, Erin Maguire, went along to record some of the performances. Curated by Una Mullally and Vicky Curtis, the event was part of the Bram Stoker Festival. It was called, rather cleverly, I think, I've Got the Shanachie, I've Got the Secret. And the theme was truth-telling and facing fear. The first voice you'll hear is Una Mullally reading a piece she wrote about her cancer diagnosis for Guts magazine.
Your body is meant to protect you. Yet one day it wakes up and a cell tilts its head like a dog does when you say its name. Today, the cell, one out of 100 million decides, today I'm going to do this. It diverges from its usual daily routine and instead does something new. The following morning, another cell looks over and squints. That looks fun. After the initial millisecond of chaotic behaviour, a pattern emerges. The random becomes uniform. In a year or so, enough cells have arrived to the party to create something inside you that is trying to kill you. Your body is meant to protect you. Instead, for no reason, no cause, no impetus, no trigger, it has built a bomb. It doesn't tell you that, but at a certain point, the timer counting down those red LED numbers will get closer to zero. Your body starts to listen. Something isn't quite right. 3, 2, 1. The scan on the table has a colour photo of something gnarly, pink and red and white and glistening. You hear yourself saying, "That's a tumour." And the doctor's eyes turn downwards. Yes, yes it is. Her hand clasps your right forearm, the type of human contact that is shorthand for bereavement. It seems as though the air has been sucked out of the room and the voices talking around you have the same fidelity as underwater screams. Your cheeks are wet. Something inside me is trying to kill me. Your body is meant to protect you. But inside it, there's a war going on, a battle for territory, a bodily coup. In the trenches of your bloodstream, cells are firing shots at each other. In the logistically important battle sites of your organs, the drawbridges are being pulled up, the sandbags laid. As in the distance, the cancer is advancing, relentless, like the zombies in World War Z. There is a box set of drama unfolding within you, and it plays on Super 8 in your brain. The effect is discombobulating. Your body is not of you, because you have no control. Things are taking place that you never planned or signed off on. Your body is meant to protect you, and somehow it didn't. The surgeon sits you down. The only part of you that moves is one tear after another. They are silent and hug the chin and curl around the neck before being absorbed by the collar of a t-shirt. He talks and then that's over. He calls down the corridor as you're floating away, walking like they do in South Park. Una? Yes? Did you see the date? I just wrote it on your chart. You know what date it is because you joked about it that morning. It is Friday the 13th. In the first few days, you gradually understand yourself to be in a state of shock. Ah, that's what this is. And all other shocks you've experienced before this, the phone call about someone dying, let's say, don't come close. You are in a suspended state. It's as if someone pauses a cartoon at a certain point where the character is blurred in two, the animation split. You're removed from yourself. Every day you wake ridiculously early, and because it's nearly summer, the mornings are brighter, and so you go for walks. You aren't walking anywhere in particular. Maybe just down the streets where one of the council's rubbish machines hums in the distance. Maybe you walk down the canal because it's so beautiful. You know that you are now encountering the world in a completely different way, but you can't articulate it. You realise the weird thing that is happening is a terrifying clarity. Because of the shock, a layer has been removed from the world and everything is illuminated. You walk towards the canal and a car door closing is the loudest noise you've ever heard. At the petrol station, the lights digitally declaring the price of diesel are so bright they almost hurt your eyes. You put on your sunglasses. A magpie cackling from a tree is bizarrely amplified. You sit on a bench and feel so weak and suspended and hypnotized by the reeds. It's 7 a.m. now. A man walks towards you with a type of gait that indicates he is still out from the night before. "Boo!" he shouts as you walk by. "Fuck you, you asshole!" you scream. He shrugs and walks away. You scream and swear again. He turns around. You look at him and shout, "You've no idea what's going on in people's lives!" He looks confused. The filter is gone. The tracing paper that you didn't even know lay over the world has been removed, and with it, there's now a strange sense of elation. Nothing matters now. Nothing. All of the things that ate into the muscles in your shoulders where you carry most of your stress, all of the things that twisted that sinew have departed, and you are freed from every single problem in the world apart from this new one. When you walk past people in the street, their faces are each more memorable and expressive than the last. In half a second, you take everything in like magic. Each wrinkle and fragment of conversation and eye colour and detail on a necklace, Every element of every frame of the world your eyes are focusing on floods your brain with colour and smell and sound. You are hallucinating reality. Zapped by shock, your brain has stepped into a zone you didn't know existed. It has accessed a hyper version of every scene, and manholes and walls and bins are vivid. Seizing this, you start going to art galleries, and the paintings are overwhelming, making you burst into tears and laugh and sit staring, totally absorbed. A day later, you walk past lads drinking pints outside Grogan's, women in the street on the phone to their friends, mums pushing buggies, hairdressers on a smoke break, guys setting up the tables outside Pygmalion, coffee drinkers on the bench outside Clement and Pico. Fuck them. Fuck all of those people. You resent everyone who doesn't have cancer. Fuck them. Why me? Why is this happening? And then at some point you move beyond why is this happening to this is happening. Then a realization lands that is so obvious now, but that you never thought of before. All of the big things that happen in your life, you don't decide them. They're not options put in front of you from which to choose. They are not things that you plan and follow through. The big things, lucky breaks, love, death, they are things that just happen. The actual control you have over your life occurs in between these things. Your body is meant to protect you, but it has no control. Back in the hospital, MRI scans feel like practice for a coffin. You try to read the expressions of the doctors doing the scans for information. What have they seen? Is it worse or better? You do not know if you are going to die very shortly, yet. So when you have an important meeting a week after your diagnosis and the surgeon tells you it isn't terminal, but it is stage 3, you are the happiest you have ever been. Someone has just told you that you can have everything back you thought was gone if you go through hell for a year. And you can do that. Your sister, who is a doctor, is in the meeting with you and seems extra relieved. When you're walking out of the hospital, she tells you you don't know how lucky you are. You could have been walking out of that meeting with them saying it was a few weeks. This idea floors you, but that's not what happened. You're alive. Your body is meant to protect you, and somehow it did. 3 months later, you are cycling down the canal, and it's sunny and warm, and the wind is just so. You push your feet on the pedals, raising yourself from the saddle, and realize that in this moment, you have never been happier. Earlier that day, you lie in the grounds of the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham and take off your shoes, and the grass feels so perfect in the soles of your feet. A few days before that, you cycled into Phoenix Park, and when you found a herd of deer, walked as close as possible to them before lying down. You opened your eyes, looking at the blue sky, and could hear them shuffling around you. That weekend, you sit in a boat on Loch Carrib and concentrate on the mayfly dapping on the water as your bait, waiting for a trout to grab it. On the drive home, the trees on either side of the road meet to form arches. On the day of the solstice, you happen to be driving past Tower Hill. You pull in and walk to the hill and stand on top in the wind and feel the earth coming into you through your feet and up into your mind. You have been waiting for something profound to happen throughout this experience so far, but nothing has, apart from this renewed appreciation for nature, which you always liked anyway, but now you get. You have always been interested in philosophies pertaining to transience, but now you understand them to the point of embodying them. You are not a crier, but you realise you are crying more at things. Things you see. The dark journey hugging Dublin Bay. A kite surfer leaping with the wind. Your parents calling to your door. The sand whipping itself across the beach like a granulated aurora borealis. Your body is meant to protect you. And somehow it will.
I bought these guys at the complex a couple of weeks ago and I couldn't not have them here. Can I welcome to the stage the Homework Collective?
Thank you. The government decreed unto the people of Ireland
that 12 women are exiled every day.
She was a student studying to improve her chances in life, saving for fees when she made a mistake.
Because of one mistake, now half of her fee will cover the airplane ticket. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
He is transgender and spent 3 hours at Dublin Airport to make them understand why his passport states he is female.
The contraception failed once and he had to explain his life to a stranger, a man.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She had 15 summers to her name. She was raped and is pregnant. Her parents brought her to England for an abortion.
She lied to school and friends, afraid of their judgment. She said she was going to England for a funeral. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
He minded their kids while she traveled with a heavy heart after the diagnosis of fatal fetal abnormality.
Speaking a foreign tongue, they faced the sorrow alone. One away and the other at home. A man.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
At 27, she does not want to be a mother. She lives with her boyfriend, and they agreed.
She has overcome obstacles to abortion before, and 10 years later she faces the same once again. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She is 23 and had a baby. They are both living with HIV. She is a recovering addict. Every day is a struggle.
She knows she can't afford another baby. She can't even afford this. She borrows money to travel. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She had to travel all the way to London from Northern Ireland, a second-class citizen despite her UK passport.
Even though she had paid her taxes just the same, she was not afforded cover by the NHS as others are. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She was an asylum seeker, arrived pregnant after being raped. She tried to get to England but was sent back by the powers that be.
She found help online, ordered abortion pills and had them delivered to the north. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She had a previous child with severe disabilities. She cares for him every hour of the day and night.
Another child with the same disabilities is too much to bear. She can't. She travels to England. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
While her cancer was in remission, she got pregnant and endangered her chance of recovery.
A passport out of date delayed her journey more. She never recovered after that. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She was against the idea of abortion until she needed one herself. She told a friend who supported her choice.
They travelled to England together. She told everyone they were on holiday. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
She lives in Ireland and needs an abortion. She could use the pills but needs a way to get them from the north. How can she find someone who can help her?
Who can she trust? She is afraid she'll be caught. She is afraid she'll be arrested. She is afraid. A woman.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
The government decreed unto the people of Ireland.
Thus 12 women are exiled every day.
The amendment was made law.
And we live as criminals.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
People of Ireland, raise your voices.
We are all worthy of our right to choose.
With performers we fell in love with when we first saw them at the much-missed squat up in Grange Gorman. They performed folk sessions around the country. We're delighted to have them with us tonight. They've got the Shanachie, they've got the Secret. Please welcome Landless.
Past my love, since you and I have been.
That was a beautiful vocal performance from Landless, who are Lily Power, Maeve Meir, Ruth Clinton and Sinead Lynch. They formed Landless a couple of years ago and they sing unaccompanied traditional songs in four-part harmony. Earlier you heard pro-choice activist The Homework Collective, and before that a piece originally published in Guts magazine by Una Mullally. An upcoming production of the much-loved ballet Coppelia has been given a modern makeover, drawing inspiration from sources as wacky and diverse as Tim Burton's Mars Attacks and X Factor. It's a witty and very pertinent show, and something we were talking to Erica Jong about earlier, inspired by the very modern, all-consuming obsession with youthful perfection, which always interests us greatly here in the Women's Podcast. Choreographer Morgan Runacre-Temple and writer Stella Feely, the women behind the ballet, join me now. Morgan, what made you think Coppelia needed updating? I mean, it's something that even people with no knowledge of ballet, they have some notion of what Coppelia is about. So what if, why you've gone and messed with it in some way?
Well, originally the director of Ballet Ireland, Anne Marr, had said to me, you know, obviously Coppelia is one of the really famous ballets of the sort of five that people have all heard of. And she said, have you ever thought about Coppelia and this, you know, it's about a man who makes a doll, the most perfect doll he can imagine, and he falls in love with the doll and he actually wants to bring the doll to life. And I sort of thought, I started looking at it, and it's because it's based on the Hoffman tale, which has got some really dark themes in it, I thought that actually that could really be brought out and be brought up into the 20th century, and the audiences now would really relate to this idea of creating a perfect woman.
Because Stella, it's your first ballet, you're an actor and a playwright, and it's your first ballet to get involved in. And there is something extraordinarily timely about this. We're now talking about sex robots, for example. Now, I may be going a little bit too far with this, but there are these dark themes that Morgan was talking about there. Is this part of what you're doing here?
Well, when we first started talking about it, Morgan was talking about how that women in pop culture, particularly somebody like Cheryl Cole, her beauty has evolved over 10 years. So we started talking about that. And the pressure on women to look more and more groomed seems to increase yearly rather than, you know, we're becoming more relaxed about it. So Cheryl Cole going from sort of grungy, gorgeous teen in a manufactured girl band is now this sort of primped, preened, big-haired, thinner version. I mean, she's still fabulous, but we thought, gosh, that's really interesting that as years go on, she gets even more and more groomed. Or people like Nicole Kidman, who they actually start to look like dolls. So we And of course, particularly Nicole Kidman, who's in her 40s, we thought that's really, really interesting that a woman is sort of basically women appear to be turning into dolls as they get older rather than turning into the sort of fabulous older versions of themselves. So we started with that and we did talk about airbrushing, photoshopping. I had an anecdote about being in New York about 3 years ago, and I was looking at this serum, Tracy Martin serum, and the lady, completely Botoxed, came up to me. She could have been 15, she could have been 50. It was very, very hard to tell. And she was saying, I think you could do with some of that cream for around your eyes. People always tell you who you are, what age you are, what size you are in New York anyway. But and I was like, oh, really? And then she pulled out a picture of Kate Winslet, and then she pulled out a picture of Dan Van Furstenberg. And completely airbrushed, because Diane von Furstenberg is nearly 70 if she's a day. And Kate Winslet was approaching 40. And she said they use this Tracy Martin serum. And I was like, seriously, you cannot be trying to sell me this serum, saying that that's how women could look if they used it. Because they both don't look like that. It's impossible. A woman that's in her late 60s, as gorgeous and all as she is, you just don't look that age. Anyway. So that's a very long-winded way of saying we did start talking about the idea of beauty. And then we looked at various other artworks, how, you know, since the time of Ovid 2,000 years ago, that there was always stories about men creating artificial women, falling in love with them, and then the women sort of either going out of control or other women were able to teach the men the folly of their ways. And also what was interesting is these works seem to coincide with developments in either technology or advances in feminism. So when this ballet was written in 1870, it was just on the cusp of the first wave of feminism. And Morgan and I thought it was a very good idea to move the technology and the advances in the status of women's rights sort of 100 years on and see what that brought about. So we moved the story to 1959. We've set it at a county fair because we wanted to explore just the fun of the fair, teen culture, American teen culture, and all that meant sunshine and fun and boys in tight jeans. And but also that if technology has moved on so far that we have actually created a doll that can appear in public. And she can also sell us a beauty product, because this is a time when really advertising came into its own, which is, of course, why Mad Men was such a great success. So this our doll is selling a product. So in the way that, you know, Unreal images of the actual models, like people like Kate Moss, who are absolutely gorgeous. But, you know, Kate Moss is in her 40s and we never see a real example of what Kate Moss looks like. She's always airbrushed to sort of in around a kind of a mid to late 20s image. So we thought, well, it is an unreal person that's selling us a product. So why not have a doll selling us the product? So they're the kind of themes that got us into... So in the original, it was an eccentric toy maker and his beautiful ward slash niece or whatever the public thought it was. And now we've got sort of the cosmetic manufacturing CEO and his beautiful creation, who's a famous model.
Who is actually a doll.
Who is a doll.
Which is amazing. Mm. Morgan, I've obviously travelled too far with the sex robot theme. because it's still only, 1959? So we haven't got anywhere near turning this into a robot. But obviously she moves exactly like a human being, because we have this reporter, which I think is another sort of new, another introduction. Hildy is a reporter, and she becomes very curious about this creature. Mm. So we have this beautiful starlet selling this product, who has this jealous reporter looking at her.
Well, I mean, when you say she moves like a human being, you know, just going back to what Stella was saying about Cheryl Cole, I don't know if you've seen her on X Factor, and when she's sitting behind her panel and how she moves, I think probably because she's kind of very highly made up, you know, the movement is quite minimal and quite considered. So Capalia, in true sort of like Hollywood beauty style, she moves very, very delicately, and I mean, she's being controlled by Dr. Capalius's remote control. So all of her movements are quite sort of subtle. Hildy, on the other hand, who is our young heroine, she is, yeah, absolutely sort of full of life and breath, and, you know, she can get down in a barn dance, and she's, you know, she's completely different from Coppelia. So the more Coppelia is very sort of rigid in her beauty and perfection, that's kind of contrasted with Hildy, who's very, very natural and real. So there is these two different kinds of movement in the ballet, which is relates back to the original, because the original has this kind of very rustic, it's set in this small town and they have a lot of rustic folk dancing. And then in the second act, all the dolls are moving in this kind of very controlled puppet-like way.
And Stella, tell me about the original dark themes of this, because it was obviously, as you say, ward slash niece. What was this woman in the ballet?
Well, actually, in Charles Nwita, who in his original libretto, it's actually very light. It's very fun. It's very light. It's no scarier than Scooby-Doo. But in the tale, in E.T.A. Hoffman's tales, they're extremely dark, as in when the man who realises that his love interest is actually a doll, he goes insane. And there's another one of those stories from Hoffman where they actually pull the doll apart. Is it they can't agree?
Well, they so the Sandman takes the eyes from children. If they don't go to bed on time, he takes their eyes and he puts them in his dolls. And yeah, they can't agree. And I think the young man that falls in love with Coppelia, thinking she's a real doll, sees her being pulled apart, and that's what sort of sends him insane.
That's what sends him insane.
He realizes that she's a doll.
So we still kept those. So they're there, but it's very light. But you still have themes of stolen souls. I mean, basically, at the end of the day, it's two men become obsessed with a doll, and it takes a real woman to sort them out. I mean, that's kind of, you know, essentially what the story is.
Right. Well, we had a conversation here last week about street harassment of women, and I notice you have Hildy stalking this poor starlet in her home. Stella?
Right.
Yes, so I'm a bit concerned about you encouraging this sort of thing.
We might need to record this bit, because we cut the reporter bit, and she's now just an avid, I mean, everybody in the late 1950s had brownies, little brownie cameras. So she's basically like a young kid taking selfies and taking photographs with friends. So I don't know if there's
and she does take it. She takes a prohibited photo of Coppelia, because obviously Coppelia isn't allowed to have any photographs in public, because, you know, on close